court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia.
Perspective on Legal for All. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude.
We're doing something different this episode. We're actually following through with a promise of something we teased the last episode.
We put out a teaser.
That's right. And if you listened to the last week's episode, then you might know what we were teasing about, or you might not. I don't know. Sometimes we're not very clear.
I hope you listened to last week's episode. I hope you listened to every week's episode.
Well, this episode is going to be about non-unanimous juries. And one of the things that brought to our attention is that Oregon, and I was not aware of this, the juries for decades have basically been permitted to convict felony defendants, except for murderers, with a 10-2 vote. And there's only one other state that allows that, where you don't have to have a unanimous jury to convict people.
And that's Louisiana.
It is Louisiana.
Louisiana, as we call it down on the bayou.
The federal government and all the other states actually require a unanimous verdict for felony crimes, which include, you know, manslaughter, arson, rape. And one of the interesting things at the time, last week when I was looking at this, there was an article that said the Oregon district attorneys were actually supporting changing this back to the unanimous jury verdict. But there's actually an update for that, too, that I've come across.
Well, we like it when we have updates.
So Oregon used to actually require a unanimous jury verdict to convict, but that all kind of changed back in 1934.
Let's take you back in time to 1934.
That's right. Doodly-doo, doodly-doo,
doodly-doo, doodly-doo. Was that Ted, Bob and Ted's Excellent Adventure?
I think it's Wayne.
Bill and Ted's.
I think it's Wayne's World.
Oh, Wayne's World. I knew it was two crazy guys. Just didn't remember, had the wrong two crazy guys.
Two wild and crazy guys.
Now, that's the Czechoslovakian brothers.
So there was some murders that took place in 1934. Jimmy Walker and Edith McLean were murdered in 1934.
Jimmy Walker, didn't they name that cheap scotch after him?
Yes. He was not killed with dynamite, though.
Oh, with dynamite!
So a man named Jake Silverman was charged with the crime, and the trial was covered extensively by the Morning Oregonian, the local paper. It was kind of like the O.J. Simpson case of the day for Oregon.
The case of the century.
Pretty much, yeah. So you have to remember, back in this time period, was kind of like wrapping up with Prohibition. In between World War One, World War Two, you had some gangsters and things like that going on.
Yeah, so, see, they're going to rub you out.
Exactly. So on April 22nd, 1933... a logger in Columbia County found two bodies along a remote mountain road near Scapoose.
Scapoose.
So, drive him out to Scapoose, see?
Where'd he get hit? He got hit right in the Scapoose.
Scapoose is about 40 miles west of Portland. And Jimmy Walker was 37, and he was a burglar who was recently released from prison. And Edith McLean, she was 38. And
did he have that on his business card?
Retired burglar?
No, not retired, still active.
And the reason they knew that they were murdered, because they were each shot twice and dumped in a ditch.
What? So
they were able to put two and two together and figure that one out.
That was some damn good detective work. You didn't even need the coroner's jury for that.
Exactly. Witnesses in the area had told cops that they had heard four gunshots the night before and later spotted a maroon Studebaker sedan driving away. So that was kind of the key evidence.
This is starting to sound like a Fargo series show here.
Oh, just wait. This is a great story. Well, not for Jimmy and Edith, but still, it's an interesting story. So the Sunday Oregonian, in a front-page article, said the slayings were attributed to Portland's gangland criminals, which, and this is some of the actual verbiage from the article, meted out its own form of punishment Friday night when it took two of its own members for a ride in the country and left their lifeless bodies beside the lonely and mountainous Dutch Canyon Road.
You know, you don't get newspaper writing like that these days.
No, you don't.
They don't even have editors anymore. I mean, they don't use spell check or anything. So, you know, that. But that is some elegant newspaper writing there.
Oh, it is. This whole podcast, I'm going to be citing to some of the writing from the day. And it's just excellent. So the way the story started, and this is kind of going to the whole story about what led up to it, not really the trial. So there was a man named Ray Moore. And he was in a hotel room on the corner of 12th and Morrison Avenue one day in April 1933 when Jimmy Walker pounded on the door, the aforementioned deceased Jimmy Walker. And Jimmy had told Ray that he had need some help because he had shot a man and he was sure he was going to be burned for it. He needed to get out of town.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, so this is where the story starts.
Well, he was more than a burglar if he'd shot a man.
Well, Ray told Jimmy that he'd help him, and he told Jimmy to check into the hotel and wait for him while he made some arrangements. So he grabbed his hat and headed out the door. He came back and introduced...
You had to have your hat.
Got
to
have a hat in those days.
they took mention of that.
He came back with his other friend, who was an ex-con. Everybody in this story is an ex-con of some sort. Larry Johnson, and he was the man who was going to get him out of town. So it was basically all settled. His buddy Ray took care of it for him. Here's Larry. He's going to get you out of town. So... all they had to do was wait till it got dark.
Ray Johnson.
That's right.
You doesn't have to call me Johnson.
So here's what Ray did. He left Jimmy at the hotel. He went straight to the nearest jewelry store. He said basically he knew some bad things were going to happen that night. He knew who Jimmy had shot. It had been somebody who was basically pretty popular in the underworld scene. And he knew that Jimmy was going to be, quote unquote, burned for it. So... what Ray decided to do was he wanted to be locked up so he could not possibly be implicated in the whole situation. So he decided jail would be the safest place to be. So
he that's went, pretty sad decision making.
He went to a jewelry store,
robbed it,
and found a tray of watches behind a plate glass window and smashed the glass and grabbed the tray of watches and went off to get a cab. And he was arrested a few minutes later. And his alibi was basically at that point set.
He called for a cab to take him to jail.
Yeah. So Jimmy...
you know why he wanted watches?
Why?
Because he knew what time it was.
it was murder time.
That's right. Burn time.
Yep. So Jimmy had gotten word to his girlfriend, Edith McLean, the aforementioned deceased Edith McLean, and he basically let her know what would happen and told her to pack up a small suitcase, and she hurried off to join him. So Edith was actually the reason and the root of all these problems. She was a popular terminology of the day, what's called a gun mole.
A gun mole?
That's right. She was like kind of a criminal.
Like Bonnie and Clyde?
Yeah, pretty much. And until a month earlier, she basically been dating this other criminal guy named Shy Frank Kodat.
Shy Frank Kodat.
Yep. Now, Shy Frank...
I don't think he was so shy.
Shy Frank was an aging safecracker, and he had actually spent a few of those years for burglary. And basically, once he got out of prison, he knew that he was going to have trouble kind of keeping up that his safecracking. Maybe, you know, as an aging safecracker, the lifestyle is kind of hard. And he'd also had picked up tuberculosis when he was in jail.
Was he hanging out with Doc Holliday?
I guess. He also had kidney disease and bad arthritis. So he had a lot of medical issues going on. He said basically that...
instead of Shy Frank, they should have called him Sick Frank.
No doubt. So basically he said that instead of going back to his criminal safe-cracking career, he was going to open up kind of a halfway house for other criminals and trying to, quote-unquote, help them out.
Yeah.
And so...
pool their resources.
Basically, what he did is he's had a halfway house that also worked as a speakeasy and also had women there as well, like I guess probably prostitutes. So he basically had a halfway house that you don't need to leave anywhere. You can just hang out here.
You got gun malls and prostitutes and ex-cons. You got them all. But what I like is in those days, you had categories of criminals.
Yeah.
You had burglars and you had safe crackers and, you know, nowadays... you have all that stuff going on, but they're all just drug addicts.
Well, it's like Ocean's 11. You have to have a contortionist.
Oh, yeah. Got to have one of those.
So basically...
a munitions specialist.
When Frank opened this up, he was kind of, I guess, going straight. But basically, he was there all, there are tons of professional crooks that were there all the time. And he basically kind of set these jobs up and set up these activities, and he never really got involved with any of them. He just kind of
set probably got money from them.
Probably so.
Yeah.
And I'm sure he probably charged a nice amount of money for the, the booze he was slinging as well.
Oh yeah.
So a lot of the criminals that were there was kind of good in one way because he was able to orchestrate these things, but it was kind of bad in another way because there's a lot of criminals there.
Yeah, and they're committing crimes.
Now, one of the criminals that was there was the aforementioned deceased, Jimmy Walker. And Jimmy came there straight from prison and stayed in the halfway house. And one article I read said he was a small-time business burglar with a big-time attitude. And he started dating or trying to hit on, basically, Edith McLean, who was...
Shy Frank's girlfriend.
So they started spending a lot of time together, and Shy Frank got really upset and started thinking, like, basically, Jimmy was going to burglar his girl.
Yeah.
So, so basically, somebody else there in the house accused Jimmy of stealing their watch, which was probably orchestrated by Shy Frank, and Shy Frank kicked him out of the premise and said, hey, you can't come back.
Yeah, well, all these thieves living here, and you're going to steal from one of them?
Yeah, they got a code of conduct.
Yeah, you can't steal from other criminals.
So Jimmy, being a obedient criminal, left the premises, and he had a decided, I guess, maybe have a few drinks because he was smarting from his eviction. But he got a little liquid courage and decided to come back and got into a screaming argument with Frank. Well, as we told you about Frank, he was he got tired pretty quick because of all his different ailments that he had. So he went off to his bedroom to rest.
Yeah.
And they, when they were having this argument, evidently they were having it in Frank's office. And so for whatever reason, Frank left Jimmy alone in his office, which doesn't seem like a good idea to leave a burglar there.
Yeah, he's burgling your girls. He's burgling others. Then you're going to let him burgle it free hand in your office.
He'd probably burgle your hamburgers too if he could.
So. Hamburglar.
So Jimmy, make no surprise here, started going through his desk. And one of the things he found in the desk drawer was Shy Frank's .38 special pistol, which was apparently loaded and ready to go. It was hot.
So that's what Lynyrd Skynyrd was singing about.
Yeah, exactly. Well, somehow, maybe because of his intoxicated state or whatever, Jimmy accidentally shot off a round from the .38 special, and as luck would have it, it careened somewhere and through the wall and actually hit Frank sitting on the edge of his bed.
Wow.
So he ran away out of the building, but basically the die was already cast. He was going to be in trouble. He was going to get burned for this. So Shy Frank ended up recovering from it. So there's that. But
with all his other ailments, now he's got a bullet in him.
Yeah, that's right. But that's where we pick up the story where Jimmy had gone to meet with Ray to try to get some help. So the story goes that the ride did arrive, and it was the maroon Studebaker, which was basically what they had said seen speeding off after the four shots were fired that night, and that Jimmy and Edith were in the back seat, and basically they thought they were making a run for her, getting out of town, but
those two guys there were there to execute them.
That's right. The next morning, they were found on Dutch Canyon Road, just west of Scappoose,
with two slugs in a ditch in Scappoose.
Yep. So,
and their scabooses were cooked.
And basically, you know, the way the story goes, it seems that Ray had double-crossed them and alerted the Shy Frank and his friends that basically what had happened with Jimmy, and he was actually shot with that .38 special.
Mm.
So that's the way the story went down with regards to all the drama.
Man, that's a lot of criminals in one place. It's no wonder.
It is.
That people ended up dead.
So the police, using their keen deductive skills, were able to...
I believe there's been a murder here.
...were able to center their investigation around a man named Jake Silverman. He was a... the paper stated that he was a one-time merchant turned hotel proprietor and occasional criminal.
Only occasionally. He was only a part-time criminal. He was a full-time proprietor.
He was a... he was a regular drinker at Kodat's at the speakeasy there.
Was there anybody in Oregon that wasn't a criminal? Were they all criminals in Oregon?
I think so.
Is that like our Australia? We packed up all the criminals in America and sent them to Oregon?
And his quote in the paper was basically that he thought that Kodat was a quote-unquote mighty fine fellow. He said that. So, but there's the main reason that Silverman became the primary suspect is because his wife owned a maroon Studebaker.
Mm-hmm.
So they were able to put it all together.
There probably was not very many maroon Studebakers in the criminal world in those days.
I don't know. I don't know what the options were for Studebakers in the 30s as far as color packages and schemes.
Maroon was probably rare.
Yeah, I think there were only five of them.
Yeah. Henry Ford said, all you need is black.
So the case actually progressed, and the prosecutors eventually charged Silverman, who was actually Jewish, with the murder of Walker and sought the death penalty. They actually never charged him with the death for McLean, but there's not really any kind of indication as to why they didn't. But he was charged with one murder. And there was a two-week trial, and it began in November, and the newspaper, the Morning Oregonian, who was having blow-by-blow coverage of this trial, described the defendant's demeanor as mirthful and one of studied disinterest, and claimed at one point that Silverman laughed off his murder charge. One of the odd things about it was that during the trial, one of the jurors, who was a Spanish-American War veteran, actually committed suicide by stabbing himself during the trial. So it was kind of an odd thing that took place.
He couldn't stand hearing about it.
I don't know. So now, on November 13th, and this is some more great writing, Silverman spent 3 hours perched uncomfortably in the witness chair, alternately describing the peregrinations on the night of the killing or waxing indignant under the cross-examination conducted by District Attorney John L. Storia. You just don't see writing like that anymore.
No.
And then on the day of Walker and McLean's murder, Silverman said he visited one or more drinking establishments and consumed variously of beer and whiskey, the paper wrote. It was brought out that he had been on what he facetiously termed a little toot.
A little toot.
That's right. And he denied that he had any part in the killings whatsoever.
So these guys' alibis, they've got this figured out. Either they'll go commit a crime and get arrested, or else they'll just be blackout drunk. So, well, I couldn't have done it. I was blackout drunk. I don't remember anything. Ask me any questions.
I was having a little toot.
Yeah. Just a little toot.
You imagine this guy like sitting in front of the jury and like he's talking about going out drinking beer and whiskey and looking over at the jury and winking. And he's like, yeah, I had a little toot. Wink, wink.
I consumed various amounts of alcohol and beer, whiskey and beer, and I had a little toot.
So once the case was fully heard and it went to the jury, they went and deliberated, and 11 of the 12 jurors wanted to convict him of the second-degree murder. But there was one juror who refused to support the majority view. And after hours and hours of deliberation, they came back with a compromise and convicted him of manslaughter. And he was later sentenced to 3 years in prison.
Which wow. is murdered two people in cold blood and got 3 years in prison.
Well, it's a far cry from the death penalty.
Well, that's true. But why was it, wasn't the death penalty if it was murder two? You said murder two, right?
Well, I think that was what because that was a lesser included, it would have been. So they were seeking the death penalty, but they weren't going to get it. So they, 11 of the 12 jurors wanted second degree murder.
I don't even know how you could throw second degree murder in there, because obviously if you drove somebody out to the countryside and walked them into the ditch and shot holes in them, that was premeditated. You planned it.
I would think so.
Yeah. I don't, murder too, it doesn't enter in like that. That just happens in, all of a sudden.
Yeah, you don't take somebody for a drive out Scapoose and not know what you're about to deuce.
Everybody knows what Scapoose is for.
And basically, this sentence made people go crazy. And there was a huge editorial, all kinds of racist undertones. And basically, there was the newspaper's opinion that the increased urbanization of American life and the vast immigration into America from Southern and Eastern Europe of people untrained in the jury system have combined to make the jury of 12 increasingly unwieldy and unsatisfactory, is what it wrote in November 1933, right after the verdict.
So they were complaining about the immigrants that were here.
Yeah, pretty much. Complained about the immigrants, the fact that Silverman was Jewish, and that basically the juror who didn't want to convict him was Jewish. And this actually wasn't the first time that the Morning Oregonian had taken an aim at ethnic jurors. There were other editorials around that time where the paper had talked about mixed blood jurors and basically said that the role that some immigrants played on juries, questioning their sense of responsibility and views on crime and punishment. So there was kind of a grassroots movement started by the newspaper at that time to...
Well, there was a lot of anti-Semitism.
Yeah, there was.
And, you know, it might be a different nationality, but it's a lot of what's going on right now.
Yeah, it's not too dissimilar.
Yeah, it's another type of situation like that. So because of that, they felt like that the lone Jewish juror was the one that held up the verdict and that he didn't do it for the right reasons.
Now,
they wanted to pack the court just like Franklin Delano Roosevelt tried to do with the Supreme Court, huh?
That's right. Now, the Oregon legislature, doing what legislatures often do, having a knee-jerk reaction to something such as this, they recommended a public vote to amend the state's constitution to allow 10-2 jury verdicts in non-murder felony cases. And also, conversely, it would have allowed juries to acquit on a 10-2 vote as well. Basically, the proponents of the amendment, which was called Measure 302-03, talked about the Silverman trial, and they put out these pamphlets with all these different things trying to explain it. And really, the newspapers in Eugene and Portland, they really urged their readers to support it and got behind it. So there was pretty much an organized front to try to push this through and make it happen. And there was no real organized opposition to it. It was basically kind of a one-sided type deal where it seemed like everybody wanted it. And it passed with 58% of the vote. And that made Oregon the only other state besides Louisiana to have non-unanimous jury system. So if you think about it, it's not really surprising there wouldn't have been any kind of organized resistance to it.
No, because most of the people they're talking about cutting out are ones that are new to the country and may not even be citizens or be able to vote.
Yeah.
So you're talking about cutting out the people that lack representation.
Or maybe not even able to understand what exactly was taking place by doing this. Because if you think about it, you don't, on the surface, just changing it to 10-2, you think, well, that shouldn't change too much, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it changes a big deal, because if you have a jury which is representative of the populace, then that minority is actually kind of excluding them and taking away their vote to a certain degree, if in fact they do that.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, not only that, if you have to find somebody, if the burden of proof is beyond a shadow of a doubt, well, if you've got one or two people saying, I don't think so, that's more than a shadow.
Yeah. I mean, that's...
I mean, you just proved the defense's case at that point.
Yeah, absolutely. The trial I had recently was on one count, was deadlocked at 10-2 on a conspiracy charge.
Mm-hmm.
My guy would have gone down for that.
Yeah, that's right. That's so, right, if West Virginia had that too, huh?
Yeah. Now, this constitutional law in Oregon has actually been appealed all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. In 1972, APODACA v. Oregon. I don't know. That's how you pronounce it. I'm struggling with that one.
Apodaca. He's from Scappoose.
Apodaca from Scappoose, Oregon. They heard the case, and there were three men who were convicted of felonies by non-unanimous juries in Oregon. They claimed that the law violated the 6th and 14th Amendments of the Constitution, and a four-justice plurality, which was led by Justice Lewis Powell, held that there was no constitutional right to unanimous jury verdict in state-level criminal cases, and that basically this law did not violate due process.
And let's clarify, if you're in Oregon and you're in a federal court, you do have to have a unanimous decision.
Exactly, because federal courts require it, as well as all the other states but Oregon and Louisiana.
Right. So it's a question whether you're in a state court or a federal court.
Yep. Now, there was actually another appeal recently in 2016 where Olin Jermaine Williams, who was an African-American man, basically wanted a retrial because there was a non-unanimous jury verdict. And they said that basically the vote by the one lone black juror who voted not guilty didn't count. And they did not get him a new trial, but it was appealed as well. So when the prosecutors wanted to change this, and they were talking about it back in January, they actually said that this law had a basis in racism, and that's why they kind of wanted to change it.
Sure, it did.
Yeah. But then actually recently, a couple weeks ago, they changed their mind and said, you know what? We decided we don't want to get rid of it now.
We decided we kind of like racism.
Yeah. So
it kind of helps us out. We've been losing ground lately.
Well, they changed their mind, but of course, they have already kind of stuck their foot in their mouth by saying it has basis in racism. So I'm sure there's going to be a lot of backlash from that, too.
Let's stuff that genie back in the bottle.
One of the things they wanted to do is they were trying to change the system a little bit. They wanted to, and this is where you can go a bit more into it, they wanted to change out the whole jury system in Oregon because part of that law said that, you know, obviously the 10-2 didn't have to be unanimous to convict. It also didn't have to be unanimous to acquit. And also it gave the accused a right to forego a jury trial and just go straight to a bench trial and have a judge decide it, and not a jury. And so actually defense counsel, they were going to try to get rid of all those things. And defense counsel didn't want to get rid of their advantage in it. So, mm-hmm. you know, it was kind of one of those, if not everybody can agree on it, then fine, we'll just not do anything. So, wow. Yeah. But anyway, the very odd and colorful story with some interesting characters, some safecrackers, burglars, and what knows else.
Well, I've got the information on Louisiana, which is the only other state of the union that has the ability to have a non-unanimous guilty plea or guilty verdict. And it even is a step further, really, because it includes everything except capital cases. Uh-huh. So it's only if you're on trial and the death penalty is at stake, does it have to be unanimous. But you could be convicted to life in prison on a 10-2 vote.
Wow. That is crazy.
So they have had also several pushes and several ones that have gone to the Supreme Court with the exact same outcome as the Oregon one. Lawrence Powell, a historian, author, and emeritus professor at Tulane University, attributed the state's split verdict system to an invidious racial intent among lawmakers who gathered at a constitutional convention in 1898. Mm-hmm. That's when this actually came about, was in 1898, for the purpose of disenfranchising blacks and poor whites. It was during the convention that the state switched from requiring unanimous jury verdicts to one permitting convictions by a vote of 9-3.
Oh, wow.
It was actually a 9-3 that it had for years. Mm-hmm. The convention's president, New Orleans lawyer E.B. Crutchnit, told the delegates, all of whom were white, that they had been summoned to eliminate from the electorate the mass of corrupt and illiterate voters who have, during the last quarter of a century, degraded our politics. So, I mean,
yeah,
it's just blatant, the motive behind it.
You know, given that era and the time, I can kind of see where that came about. But the Oregon one's kind of, it's an outlier, I'd say.
Well, that's true. It's probably modeled off of the fact, though, that this one existed.
Yeah.
And Louisiana is where they probably got the idea that they could do it.
That's true.
That this one was there. But, you know, they deny that theirs is, even though you have the writings in the paper at the time talking about the uninformed masses that are immigrating in and stuff like that, was just a veiled way of saying those ignorant immigrants.
Yeah.
You know, is what they were saying. And, you know, that's obviously racism, but then it's the same thing. This is just blatant racism here that it's rooted in, and yet no one has taken the steps to do away with it. He says the delegates apparently reviewed the data at the time that showed blacks made up 14.7% of the electorate. Reingold noted, meaning a proportional representation would have called for an average of 2 black jurors on every 12-member jury.
Yeah.
So the state later adopted a 10-2 standard at the 1973 Constitutional Convention because there was an outcry to go to the unanimous jury. So as a compromise to keep them from going to the unanimous jury, they said, well, we'll change it from 9-3 to 10-2.
And that was in 72?
Yes, 73. 73?
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And so they changed it to 10-2 at that point. But you're talking about from 1898 to 1973, three people could say you were innocent and you still could go to life in prison.
That's insane.
They've done a lot of different studies on this thing. They have a group, you know, one of those innocence projects.
Yeah.
And they look at people on sitting in prison, and they've looked specifically at these ones with the split decisions. And what they found on about a fourth of people that were convicted with these, that they ended up being innocent.
Hmm.
It says here in this, they studied 40 prosecutions and convictions that resulted in exoneration. 20 were tried in a manner that allowed conviction by a non-unanimous verdict. And in at least 9 of these 20 cases, a guilty verdict was returned by a non-unanimous jury. Richard Davis, a staff attorney for the organization, said Tuesday that 2 more split jury exonerations have arisen since then. So that's 22 exonerated people who could have been convicted by a non-unanimous jury and 11 who actually were.
Yeah, I mean, they have the data to back that up. It shows that those kinds of jury verdicts are inherently not accurate. It's kind of crazy to think that in this day and age that that's still going on.
Well, and if you think about it, it would have ruined a classic piece of literature.
Which one?
12 Angry Men. That would have been a real short show because that one guy, when Henry Fonda stood up and said, I think he's innocent, too bad. Okay, give him his vote. 11-1. Let's go. Put him in jail.
I've actually never seen that.
You've never seen that?
No.
That's a great show. I'd like to be in that someday.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You all should do it.
Well, you can't get the audiences for it.
What do you mean?
They like to turn out for the big Disney musicals. They don't come just see, you know, what we call just a straight play, you know, a non-musical.
Yeah.
Well, I guess you don't get the audiences for that.
It's summertime. People like to be out and see music.
Did we cross over? Am I on Still Waiting for Guffman? Is that what we're talking? We're talking shows now. How did that happen? That's the wrong podcast. I got confused.
You lured me in with that 12 Angry Men. If you don't know.
In that, he stands firm that he finds him innocent. Mm-hmm. And so they end up staying in and, you know, going and going and going till eventually at the end, they all agree he was innocent. But it was the one voice that stood up and said they're not. And they've gone through a bunch of studies because the argument that they make and have made in Louisiana, and I would say in Oregon too, is that it's a matter of efficiency. You get less hung juries.
Oh, no doubt.
You know, they say that, you know, that really that's all it's doing is influencing the ones that would have been hung juries.
Yeah.
And they're saying that it's more efficient. It saves the taxpayers money. It's probably right. You're pointed in the right direction. But there again, you look at the percentage, and they even tried to, Louisiana, they tried to take it a step further. They tried to, in some of their trials, they can have 6-member juries. Mm-hmm. They tried to make those where it didn't have to be unanimous. 5 out of 6 was going to be good enough.
Wow.
On a 6-member jury. Whereas before, even Louisiana had said all 6, it has to be unanimous if you have a 6-member jury.
Yeah.
They tried to change that to 5 out of 6, but that didn't pass.
Well, it kind of changed your whole dynamic and goal of what you're doing as a criminal defense attorney, because I've always thought, like, I just got to convince one of them. Mm-hmm. You know, that was my whole goal.
Well, and if you look at the language, you know, beyond a reasonable doubt.
Yeah. That should be about 99% probably.
Yeah. I mean, that's less than one person.
Yeah.
So I don't know how you can go beyond a reasonable doubt and have 1 or 2, which is what, like 17%?
I'm not good with math.
Be 17% of the people don't believe you. That's beyond a reasonable doubt, if you ask me. I mean, what's a reasonable doubt? 25%?
No, that's way not enough.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It really seems out of step. And when you look at Louisiana, that was, you know, it was in the throes of the Jim Crow fading, all those laws. So it was like a last ditch effort to put people in their place.
Yeah,
you know, when they did that and squelch their voice, and then you have Oregon that came along for basically the same type reason. It was a different people they were racist against.
Yeah.
There's no way you can argue that this is anything but that. I mean, I just don't see the logic. And yes, for efficiency, but you know, our judicial system, that's not the kind of efficiency that we need where you're incarcerating innocent people.
No, I agree. We already have enough people being incarcerated. The United States has more than anybody else in any other country. So, yeah, I think efficiency in that aspect is not really what we need.
And that is, in a way, one of the things they didn't come right out and say it, but they said this was a way to re-enslave people, too, when they did it in 1898, when they said, you know, we'll do this and we can put more black people in jail and then have them work for us, you know, with all the chain gangs and everything else when they used to have them out working hard labor and all that kind of thing. So this was a way that they thought they could bring them back in and through the system lawfully have slavery.
Yeah.
And, you know, Louisiana, why didn't the other states do that? Well, they kind of felt like Louisiana was an outlier in several other things that happened after the Civil War and stuff like that. So they kind of just left that alone over there and everybody else, you know, went along with the rest of the world.
Well, Louisiana is somewhat different, too, in that it was not so much descended from English common law, but also has like Napoleonic code from it, right, as well. So it is a little bit different, too.
The French influence.
Yes.
The Cajuns on the bayou. My Uncle Billy was a Cajun on the bayou.
Yeah, you've talked about Uncle Billy before.
Yeah, he'd take you out crabbing and say, boy, if one of them crabs clamps down on you, he won't let go till he hears thunder. And I believe that. I believed Uncle Billy.
He's probably right.
Yeah.
A couple minutes ago, Tommy was talking about Still Waiting for Guffman. So if you don't know what that is, that's a podcast that Tommy does with my sister Mary, and they talk about theater.
That's right. Our 25 years, amateur perspective on 25 years of community theater.
That's right. So if you haven't given it a listen, you should definitely give it a listen and check it out.
You don't have to be a theater person to enjoy it. Hopefully there's enough amusing anecdotes and interesting information that, you know, you'll still find it interesting to listen to.
I, for one, am not a theater person, but I still enjoy it.
Well, thank you, Michael. And I will slip you the money for paying that as soon as the podcast ends.
Let's not wait till it ends. Go ahead and give it to me now.
My wallet's upstairs. I'll get it all the way out.
Well, that's going to bring us to
Legal Briefs.
So legal briefs is the part of the show where we go over different legal terms that we talked about on the show. Usually I'll ask Tommy some questions to see if he can remember what they meant. And sometimes he'll ask me questions to see if I know what they meant. So this one's going to be a little bit different. It's going to have a bit more of the 1930s era influence in it.
Yeah, see?
What is a speakeasy?
A speakeasy is it's an illegal bar, basically. It operates outside the normal parameters of a bar and is run by criminals, apparently.
And they've also, that's true. They're also sometimes called a blind pig or a blind tiger.
Yeah.
Why, I don't know. And that they basically came into being around Prohibition.
Well, I think that's because that was, like you say, during Prohibition. I think Taylor covered some of this
when she was on that one.
And you couldn't buy drinks, but you could pay to go in a place, and they gave you drinks. So you were paying when you came into the speakeasy. You were paying to see the blind pig.
Oh, that's right. We have a blind pig inside. Come see it.
Yeah. So you're paying for that, and then you go in and you get alcohol. But you weren't buying the alcohol. You were paying to see the blind pig.
That's right. Taylor did explain that.
Yeah.
That was on the first Christmas Spirits episode, I think we did.
That's right.
To jump to a legal question now. Plurality. What is a plurality opinion?
That means that there were several different opinions as to what yes or no or whether it was right or wrong or whatever. There was not just one, and there were several reasons why it went, but not all of them agreed.
Yep, there's no single opinion which supports the majority of the court. And basically, the plurality opinion did not receive the support of more than half the justices, but it received more support than any other opinion. So it was kind of like a plurality opinion. It's kind of like a 10-2 jury, sort of.
Yeah, so I guess so.
That case, when it was appealed to Oregon, to the Supreme Court, that the 10-2 jury thing, basically that was a plurality opinion. So the non-unanimous jury was non-unanimous with the justices too, which that might be ironic. I don't know.
It is kind of ironic.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, well, that's why they ruled that way, I guess.
What is a hoosegow?
A hoosegow?
Yeah.
It's a jail.
That's right.
And they have them in Scapoosie.
That's right. And we didn't actually mention hoosegow, but I thought I'd just throw it out there because I figured, why not?
You figure that was turb of the time, huh?
That's right. And then the last question is, what is a gun mole?
I was going to ask you that, too. A gun mole. A gun mall is the way I've always heard. It's M-O-L-L, isn't it?
Yeah, mall.
Gun mall. And that's like Bonnie. Bonnie was always referred to as a gun mall, which means basically she was a criminal, too. And wouldn't mind shooting you down or whatever. So
yeah, they are a female companion of a professional criminal.
There you go. So they're riding dirty too.
They're riding dirty.
Well, I've got one for you.
Uh-oh.
Do you know what famous rapper was convicted of murder on a 10-2 split vote?
In Louisiana, I guess.
In New Orleans. Yeah.
Famous rapper.
Mm-hmm.
10-2, Louisiana. Adult.
C murder. Seems appropriate, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, like C the letter dash murder.
Yeah.
His real name was Corey Miller, but he went by the handle C murder.
I'm assuming that when they announced the case, they did not say the state of Louisiana versus C murder, because that would be probably pretty bad for a jury to hear that.
Well, they probably said Corey Miller, a.k.a. C murder.
Oh, I'm sure that came out, that was his nickname.
Yeah, you know they had to have had that. He probably had it tattooed on his forehead or something, too, anyway. So So they would have seen it. Don't all, you know, all rappers have their tattoos and everything.
I could just see like the state attorney or the prosecutor saying his nickname was C Murder. I mean, objection, judge. That is extremely detrimental to my client's case.
If you look him up in the phone book, you'll find him under C Murder.
Those are those objections you want to make. It's like, oh, that's horrible for my case.
You're prejudicing the jury.
So, well, this was, I mean, not really a laughing subject because I think it's a very serious subject that needs to be fixed. But especially the case in Oregon with all the different characters that came into play with all their nicknames and their different occupations as safecracker,
right,
business burglar.
And I mean, I really feel like they had to have borrowed that from Louisiana, that for somebody to have come up with the idea, hey, why don't we do this? It's got to be because it already existed.
Yeah.
And when you look at why the one in Louisiana came about, say, well, you know, how do we defend this? You know, how do the people of the state defend that and go along with it? I mean, even if you base it on efficiency, I still make the case it's not worth saving a few dollars if you're putting innocent people in prison. And it also, in a way, it just undermines the whole American judicial system.
Yeah, I agree. I am against it.
Well, being a defense attorney, I figured you would be. Even though they make the argument, you know, you can also get acquitted 10 to 2.
Well, I'll tell you what. I bet if you polled the all the different state attorneys and prosecutors and all the other 48 states and federal prosecutors, mm-hmm. they would all probably unanimously, at least to a 10 to 2 ratio, say it's a bad idea.
Yeah. I think you've got to, especially with laws like that. I mean, with penalties like that hanging in the balance.
Yeah.
You know, when you're talking about in Louisiana, everything except a capital crime.
Well, I think it's probably too is in Louisiana, Oregon at this point, a lot of the attorneys who support it maybe have just become so accustomed to it, they don't want to change it. Mm-hmm. It probably doesn't have anything to do so much with the racism aspect, at least I would like to hope not, but they probably just become very accustomed to it. And they're just kind of like, well, it's the way we've always done it. So we kind of like it. So let's just keep it that way. But the undertones is that it does have, I believe, an effect of keeping minorities.
It's silencing their voice.
Yeah, pretty much.
And it's also, it's undermining one of the pillars of the system is vigorous debate in the jury room as to what took place and, you know, what it should be. You're eliminating that debate because if you go around the room and you say 10 to 2 guilty, those two never get to have their say. And never get to have that debate where you might hear another story, even though you voted guilty, you might hear another opinion say, you know what, I didn't think about that. So you are eliminating vigorous debate in the jury room, which can't be good for justice.
Yeah, I agree. It's a bad idea.
Then we'll start our campaign right after we get the school situation straightened out so that we don't have people walking in schools with AR-15s, and we'll start on this next.
Solve all the problems.
That's right.
All right.
Start at the top and work our way down.
Thanks to everybody for listening. And thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Doctor, Lawyer, Indian Chief.
And thanks to the McElroy Stable of Podcasts for the use of their recording studio. Their podcasts include Mabim Bam, Sawbones, and Still Buffering, as well as many other fine offerings. And please take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you liked us. If you didn't, well, then not so much.
You're not supposed to say that.
You always edit that out, though, right?
Usually.
Good.
This has been Court Appointed. I'm Mike Meadows, your co-host. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am...